Well, welcome to the latest edition of the ASI cast. Now, in recent podcasts, we've discussed the global battle for content as the growing number of SVOD services battle it out to have the top shows. But we haven't focused too much on the current state of sports rights and television. So we thought we'd put that right and have a chat with Minal Moda of industry analysts Ampere. So welcome to the ASI cast, Minal.
Thank you, Richard, for having me.
Now, what prompted us to get in touch was the recent furore over the attempted breakaway Super League for European clubs in football, which was followed last week in the UK by the unprecedented announcement that may have slipped under the radar for some people that the Premier League TV deals with BT, Sky and Amazon will simply be rolled over for another 3 years instead of going out to tender. So taking that Premier League deal first, is that a surprise and what are the implications? Is this potentially the last few years of an era before gravity asserts itself on football prices?
Yeah, so I actually don't think it's a surprise from the perspective of the Premier League. I think they would definitely have pushed for this. It will provide them security for the next 3 years. And also it will help them avoid any embarrassment in terms of a domestic rights decline. I think we've definitely reached a bit of an edge in terms of that rights bubble in the UK. You know, unless at the moment we've got a status quo between Sky and BT where they don't really want to outbid each other anymore. So unless in the next 3 years, when the next right cycle comes through, a huge new competitor comes in and they put down a huge marker, I think all of this will now suit the likes of Sky.
So that's a good question. You say it suits Sky. I mean, what seemed bizarre to me was why BT, Sky and Amazon didn't want it to go out to an auction, because presumably the price might have gone down. Because, I mean, estimates are currently that Sky and BT are currently paying around £9 million per match and Amazon about £4.5 million for their streaming deal. I mean, that's presumably primarily to sell boxes, you know, Sky boxes or BT broadband boxes. But I can see what's in it for the Premier League. I'm not quite sure I can see what's in it for the broadcasters.
I think there's a little bit of ease of life. Like, you know, these tender processes internally will take up a huge amount of manpower and a huge amount of time. So there's a little bit of, okay, this makes our lives a bit easier. But then whilst the price might have gone down, there's also a slight danger. We saw news reports earlier this year of the likes of DAZN looking at the Premier League packages. So if you had some of these new entrants come in, while it might not have pushed the prices down, it might have made it more competitive, which these guys don't want it to do, and they might have actually had to pay a little bit more. And I think there's a little bit of a PR play as well here for the broadcasters, because there has been an increase in the solidarity payments, which are being pushed down towards the lower leagues by this new deal. It kind of shows, look, we've not made the life of the Premier League more difficult. We're still supporting football in the country. And actually, we're now supporting the lower leagues at a bigger level. So I think there are a few different factors which were contributing from a broadcaster perspective.
And presumably, the government getting involved, which is unprecedented, because they had to approve this not going out to tender. The timing was right in terms of the pandemic, because it was sort of seen as football suffered enough in the last 18 months. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think this would have happened if the pandemic hadn't hit. Like, I just don't think the government would have approved it. I don't think the Premier League would have even tried to go without a competitive tender, just knowing that it would never have been approved.
You mentioned DAZN. I mean, they've cropped up a few times in past ASI casts. Can you clarify a bit more who they are, what their power is, and what's their model for acquiring sports rights?
Yeah, so DAZN are a sports OTT platform. They've actually been around for a few years now, and they found quite big success in Japan initially. They acquired the rights to the domestic football there, the J-League, and they actually worked with the J-League to increase attendances, and they managed to get more fans in the stadium by making this content more accessible. And then they last year went global with like boxing rights. They've made quite a big splash in Europe as well. You know, they've gone in for the Serie A rights in Italy, which they've taken away from Sky. So it does feel like they're moving much more into European football, which again is another reason why the broadcasters maybe wouldn't have wanted this to go out to tender, because there was potentially a genuine, you know, fear that DAZN might get involved in the UK.
There's also rumours that DAZN might be interested in buying BT Sport, because BT Sport are keen to, offload BT Sport, from what I gather. It's achieved its objective in promoting BT broadband. So that's an interesting wrinkle to the deal, because if DAZN may end up having to buy BT to get the rights rather than bid for them independently.
Yeah, I actually think that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing for DAZN, because all the setup would already be there if they were to acquire BT Sport. You'd think of like the carriage deals would already be in place. And I used to work at 11 Sports, and I know from that type of background how important a TV carriage deal is for OTT products. So I don't necessarily think that would be a bad thing for DAZN.
Because they'd inherit Gary Lineker and everything else rather than having to start again from scratch. That makes sense. What's the current situation with the overseas rights to Premier League? Are they still holding up in terms of value?
Yeah, so actually the overseas rights have done quite well with the Premier League. I'm thinking of the huge deal that they signed in 2018 with the Nordic Entertainment Group across Scandinavia. So that went for 2 billion between 2022 and 2025. And it was a 20% increase on the previous deal, which is absolutely huge for the Premier League. And another one I think you can kind of point to is the renewed deal in MENA with beIN Sports. Now, there wasn't an increase, but actually they managed to sign it for exactly the same rights value, which in the current market, especially in Saudi and in the Middle East, where you have so much sports piracy, is actually a pretty big coup for the Premier League.
What's the balance now? Is it close to, or is it actually the case that there's more sports rights money for the Premier League outside of the UK than just from the UK deal? It must be getting pretty close.
Yeah, I think so, because I know that in the last rights cycle, the international rights went up again, which meant that the overall rights value went up. So actually international is now kind of propping up that rights value, that overall rights value for the Premier League. So it is definitely becoming more and more important. And if we do think that it will stagnate or decline in the UK, I imagine more of their focus will start going towards the international rights and putting more time and manpower in selling those.
There's also this interesting, you mentioned the impact of the pandemic in terms of this bidding process, that the other impact of the pandemic has been in the UK that people have been able to watch every single match, and that the 3 p.m. rule and the five games a week has gone out the window. Clearly, if things are getting back to normal, the TV companies will want to get back to that model, because that's what they've paid for and it costs them more money to cover extra games. But do you think that Pandora's box can be shut now? Is there now going to be an expectation when we eventually have a new deal that all games will be covered? It seems strange that you can be in the Nordics and watch a game from your favourite team that fans in the UK can't watch because of the restrictions.
Yeah, I think that 3 p.m. blackout rule has just been around for so long now. And the whole premise behind it is to help attendances for the live games. But if you think about it, if you are, say, a Man United fan living in London, the likelihood of you attending a 3 p.m. game when the capacity of the stadium isn't as big as the fan base in the UK is probably quite low. So being able to see it on TV and giving the TV companies another package and offering that, I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. My personal opinion, though, is that while Stadia capacity continues to be below 100%, some of those games might still be free, but as soon as we hit 100%, my hunch is we'll go back to the status quo and everything will be behind a paywall again.
Yeah, that makes sense. Moving on to the European Super League, as they branded it, clearly we just a behind the scenes revelation, we were planning to do a podcast immediately on the announcement with Manal, but then things were overtaken by events, so we thought we'd let the dust settle for a few weeks and see what the fallout was. But I guess my question would be, what damage has been done to the image of the, you know, the Premier League and Champions League sports rights? And is there a feeling that it's inevitable, that this attempt may have failed, but some form of breakaway European Super League is inevitable?
So I'll take that in a couple of chunks in terms of, so the damage, I don't think there's been a lot of damage to the Premier League and Champions League rights necessarily. You know, they've managed to bring this back from the brink with all the legalities and stuff from it. And also the fans really helped. And they are now back to a form of status quo. Where the damage I think has been done has been in terms of from a fan and a club perspective. So from the side of fans, you know, there's even further mistrust of the owners, and that's manifested itself with protests at Old Trafford and at the Emirates. And then from a club point of view, right before the announcement of the European Super League, a lot of them resigned from seats of power on the European Clubs Association board, on UEFA's board. So they've now lost those seats at the table and the influence that has come with it. So those, I think, are quite big, you know, ramifications on the back of it. And then I suppose your question of, is it inevitable? If you had asked me that maybe a year ago, I think I would have said yes. You know, these clubs have got so much power. But I think this shows that maybe it isn't. You know, they played their hand, and the clubs, you know, their bluff has now been called, and they weren't able to make it happen with this element of surprise this first time round. And actually what's now happened is there may be potential government legislation in the UK. There's a new Premier League charter which is aiming to stop anything like this happening in the future. So even if they do try again, I think there will be, it will just be much more difficult, and there'll be way more like legalities and loopholes that, that they're gonna have to jump through in order to make it work.
I guess the other interesting aspect of it was that clearly the Italian and Spanish clubs were much keener on this than the English clubs. It varied amongst the English clubs, but there is a real concern at clubs like Barcelona about their future financial situation. And also some people have somewhat semi-jokingly almost portrayed this as less of a European Super League, as an attempt by the Italian and Spanish clubs to join the Premier League, which is six English clubs were allowed in it compared to two from the other countries. What's the relative status of the Champions League and Premier League in terms of international rights? Is this European Super League also perhaps a concern about the growing domination of the Premier League?
I don't think it's a growing domination. I think the Premier League always has dominated, like the rights values globally. We actually ran some analysis to see which clubs would benefit from being in the European Super League versus not being in it. And at that point, we kind of took into consideration the threat of not being allowed to play in the domestic leagues. And actually, I think AC Milan were the only club who would be better off just by being in the European Super League. I think that when you look at the financials behind it, the amounts of money that they believe they would make through their rights revenue was way more than what the Champions League is making at the moment. So I think there was a slight overinflation of that, which might have been pushing some of the Spanish and Italian clubs to think, oh, we're going to make quite a lot of money out of this. Whereas I don't necessarily think from a personal point of view, they would have hit the numbers that, that were coming out.
Now, you mentioned that the rights. It's interesting that you might have assumed that before this announcement was made, that they had a pretty good idea of who would be buying those rights. It was fascinating that BT and Sky in the UK abandoned all attempt at objectivity. And you could argue that the demonstrations at Stamford Bridge and Old Trafford was much stirred up by BT and Sky's coverage, because they knew, presumably, it wouldn't be them who would be able to afford it. So who do we think would have bought these rights? And it seems strange that they didn't come forward, that seemingly, from what I've read, the European Super League had a valuation of the rights, but they didn't necessarily have Amazon in their back pocket or someone to say, yes, it's us.
Yeah, I actually don't think BT and Sky, it's not a case of not being able to afford the rights. I think they just read the scenario. So like they would have been on Twitter, they would have been on social media, seeing the reaction of the fans. And, you know, they are UK broadcasters at the end of the day. And whilst we were being called legacy fans by the European Super Leagues, that is their customer base, right? So they were angling towards the sentiment that was coming out of the UK. And I think by distancing themselves, it was a play to say, you know, to their current customers, we haven't sanctioned this. We're not saying that we will give money to this, just as a means of distancing themselves. I actually don't know who would have come in for those. Amazon could have been one, but they also put out a release to say that they hadn't been consulted, that they were not one of the broadcast partners. So bit by bit, it felt like the European Super League were actually, if not alienating, but forcing the hand of these broadcasters to have to distance themselves from it. So then it does beg the question, in a market like the UK, if you've pushed away the biggest sports broadcasters, who would pay the sums of money that you're asking for? And I think that's where the fan sentiment comes in as a really strong force, because at the end of the day, those are the customers of these broadcasters. So they're not going to want to annoy them to that extent.
Mm. It also makes you wonder how these guys became billionaires in the first place. To completely muck up this incredibly controversial announcement, it's just incredible.
I think there was potentially, you know, one eye on the way the US sports are run and the way that, you know, the rights values are going in the US, because obviously Liverpool and Man United and Arsenal all have American owners. So they will have an understanding of how it works over there. Whereas I think they don't realize that in Europe, we've always had relegation. We've always had promotion. We've never had a closed shop. It's always been about achieving something based on merit. So, you know, I'm sure there are pros and cons, because it obviously works in the US, but we've never had that structure in Europe. So I think if you were going to do it, there had to be an education process first before saying, no, this is just how we're going to do it, which came across slightly arrogant, actually. And I don't think, you know, it all boils down to the fact that if the fans are not behind it and the broadcasters are not behind it, how was it ever going to work?
Mm. You mentioned the different way in which sports work in the US. Also, sports rights work very differently, don't they, in terms of you know, particularly things like the NFL and its presence on terrestrial television. In the US, presumably sports rights are still as massive as they've ever been.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have seen it from some of the news that's been coming out in the last few months. You know, there has been huge growth in spending in the US, which kind of bucks the trend that we've seen in Europe. We've seen Amazon, they've increased their spend on the NFL to $1 billion. We've seen ESPN have just paid $1.4 billion for the rights to La Liga to have house that on ESPN. And then even the MLB, I think their deal with Turner increased by 45% on the previous deal. I think we've got to remember that those rights, you know, they're much longer than the European ones are. So there's much more stability in the market in terms of the broadcasters know that there won't be in 3 years' time another competitive bid where we might have to increase our spend by X amount. This is just how much we've increased our spend. So maybe those uplifts don't come as often as they do in European sport. But yeah, I mean, the values that come out of US sports are just insane.
When we were chatting to your colleague Guy about Netflix and Amazon, one of the things he highlighted was the current trend for them to collect global franchises like Star Wars, and the latest rumoured one is Amazon to acquire the studio that makes James Bond, for example. What we're interested about the US sports is that clearly they could be seen in a similar light, but how exportable are they around the world, because they're not as global sports as you know, Premier League or Champions League, for example. Could you see a time when there's a global deal for NFL around the world, all on Amazon, or is it very much a US versus the rest of the world phenomenon?
So our consumer polling shows that some of the US sports, like NBA, have got quite a big international appeal. So they have good following in LATAM, in Asia, and in Europe. But outside of that, the fan bases tend to be significantly smaller. So it therefore makes the opportunity a lot smaller too. I don't think you're ever going to get to a point where you have like a global rights deal, because the value of those rights in the US are just so much higher than they are outside of the US. And then I guess outside of the US, you also have to consider the direct-to-consumer platforms, which a lot of these US sports rights already have. So, you know, you've got the NFL Game Pass, you've got NBA League Pass, UFC Fight Pass. There are so many of these. So the revenue that you would get from these rights deals would have to be higher than the revenues that the direct-to-consumer platforms are already bringing in. And if you have like a small number of highly engaged sports fans, if they've already signed up to this direct-to-consumer platform, is there going to be a lot of opportunity to grow that audience? So from a streaming perspective, I'd probably be a bit cautious and say, maybe that's not where we want to go, because the opportunity might not be as big as it could potentially be for something like football.
Going back to the European Super League, and this is relevant, bear with me. Andrea Agnelli, who's the president of Juventus, probably the main driver behind the idea, gave a number of slightly bizarre interviews around the time. One of them, he talked about the claim that young people weren't watching football anymore, and bizarrely suggested that they could either buy subscriptions to watch the last half hour of the match when it got really exciting, or that games should be 60 minutes long because they couldn't concentrate for that long. I mean, he was massively derided for that, but is he right in the sense that are young people actually more likely to be into esports now? And ironically, those are global, and you could imagine a global interest in Call of Duty 10 or whatever as an esport. Is there a long-term threat, just as a final question, I guess, is there a long-term threat to the continued value of sports if young people can't be encouraged to continue to go or even attend? It's incredibly expensive to attend Premier League soccer at the moment. So the average age of people with season tickets seems to be going up and up.
Yeah, I think that there's twofold to this, right? That like young people, I think this phenomena of 18 to 24s not being that interested in sport has kind of always been around, because at that age, you're maybe at university, you're starting your first job, your priorities might be slightly different. And then once you get your own, like, your first place, you might then start buying pay TV and start getting into sport. Although, you know, there is that argument that fan-based fandom is made from a very young age. So if you don't capture people at like 6, 7, 8 years old, you've kind of lost them for life. I think what's different about it now is that there is so much competition for attention and eyeballs. Sport isn't just competing with esports, as you said, it's competing with Netflix, it's competing with YouTube, it's competing with TikTok. There is so much more media around just generally that trying to engage people is just that little bit harder. And you know what he was saying about being able to buy the last 30 minutes of a game, the NBA, there's a company in the US called Buzzer, and they are allowing people to buy like the last 10 minutes of an NBA game, because that's like, that tends to be like the most exciting bit. And that's kind of to tap into, you know, what you were saying about trying to get younger audiences, or just people who maybe don't want to watch an entire match because it might be too expensive, to still engage with the competition in one way or another. I don't think it works necessarily with football, because, you know, I just think it's not as end-to-end as, say, basketball is. It's not as exciting. I just don't think that concept would maybe work as well. And as for shorter matches, I just don't think that would ever work. But, you know, I don't think there's, I think there are a few areas where there may be some longer-term threats because of all the different entertainment on offer. And if sport doesn't become slightly more accessible, and it doesn't put itself in front of new audiences, there may be quite a lot of struggles. And we've seen that with the likes of golf and F1, who have very aging audiences. The one thing football has for it is the fact that school kids love playing it. Football is like in the DNA in terms of it's such an accessible participation sport, and that then becomes a route into watching it as well, I guess. So it will always have that going for it.
And then there's also the FIFA video game franchise to draw kids in. Certainly my godson almost speaks about football like it's a video game when he talks about players got good skills.
Yeah.
They can be rated on a card or something. But anyway, well, brilliant. Thanks for that, making sense of what's been a pretty complicated last few months in terms of sports rights. That's been a really helpful oversight. And hopefully we'll pick up with you soon to see how the market's developing. But in the meantime, thanks for your time, Anna.
Thanks for having me.